Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast, and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how
it is time for It's the Law segment of Dresser After Dark. Michael Hohmeyer with us. Michael, hey, welcome back.
Thank you, Michael Ray. It's always great to be with you.
How are you?
I am good. Thanks.
Good. I'm taking Prozac.
Uh-oh.
Did you see the address that the president did today?
I was just hearing about it on the news coming back to the office from a conference.
You know, it's very interesting with what's going on with him. He's totally alienating Israel, our only friend in the Middle East. I mean, our only real friend in the Middle East. He basically said that that what he wants Israel to do, that what we want him to do, what we want Israel to do, is to go back to the 1967 borders that were established originally, and that's the only way that they'll establish peace over there. Which Netanyahu has already spoken, the premier, the prime minister of Israel. I've heard flack all over the place that that's not what's going to happen. There's a neutral space between Palestine and Israel, which was where the old border was, and that's where the protection is. And what Israel is saying is if you bring it border to border, that's very dangerous for Israel, and that's really not the way to create some kind of a peace. So I don't quite understand the politics of the philosophy behind it, because liberal Jews out of Hollywood, out of different places in the country are starting to stand up and say, what are you saying here? So it's going to be very interesting to see what kind of a reaction, and I don't understand what the dynamic was that caused him to move in that direction. Looking at it was not bright.
It certainly wasn't. His poll numbers are tanking even without adding this fuel to his fire. And I have to say, it's really an unprecedented kind of backstabbing thing to do to our once stalwart ally, or of whom we were once their stalwart ally.
Sure.
This whole experiment has been tried once before in a place called Gaza, and it didn't work out very well. Israel withdrew out of the southern part of Lebanon. Israel withdrew out of Gaza, and what has it gotten them? This is not realistic. It's not going to happen, and all it's going to do is drive a number of people who support Israel to say this president does not deserve more time.
So, but Michael, even in addition to Israel, take a look at some of the things that are going on right now. In the middle of our economic crisis, he wants to send billions of dollars to South America. He's going to go to Brazil. Brazil, we want Brazil to drill for oil, and we'll be the great customer of theirs. Instead of us drilling, we're going to buy it from somebody else. The other thing he wants to do is there's a package going on right now that he's going to go to some of the eastern countries, the Middle Eastern countries. We're going to give them money so they can create jobs so their economy can come back and they'll have something to look forward to. How do you put money in another country to create jobs when we have the kind of problem that we have right here in the United States? Something is not making sense here. I'm trying to make as best sense as I can out of it. I'm trying to look at it from a neutral perspective. I can't do that. It just doesn't make any sense.
Oh, I sure understand that confusion. I can tell you, it seems to me the only explanation that makes any sense is to say that this man does not, in fact, view America as exceptional. He thinks that we are too wealthy, we've been throwing our weight around for too many years, and we need to be cut down to size, and he's doing that by what he's doing to our standard of living, to our expectations for the future, both ourselves and our children's expectations, and he's making us from being an extraordinary country to being an ordinary country. So that the things that he won't allow us to do, he's shipping out to Brazil, or he's allowing other nations to mine, to drill for oil off our coastlines, but not us. It must be that he thinks we are not special and that we've held ourselves out as special for too long, and this is the way he can even out the equation. I don't think most Americans would agree with that policy, but that seems to be the policy that explains the fact that he thinks, you know, his statement was that America is exceptional the same way a Brit probably thinks that Britain is exceptional and a Frenchman thinks that France is exceptional. It's not the same thing. We are different than those countries, and he doesn't seem to either understand the idea of American exceptionalism or believe in it. And that's a mistake I don't think most Americans are happy with.
Well, this is the confusion, and Michael, I have to use the word confusion here. The confusion is, where does he get the support that he gets? Now, I know the polls are dropping, but there's still 40-some-odd percent, 46%, I guess it was the last time I saw it, that were in favor of him and think he's doing a good job. Where are the blinders? That's what is not making any sense. Everything that what America is supposed to be isn't. He's talking about the border. You know, everything's great on the border. Well, they just caught a couple, three truck loads of immigrants being smuggled across the border. If you take
hundreds
a look,
of them, yes,
yes. By the way, it's $7,000 a piece. Those trucks were worth millions of dollars to someone. And if you take a look,
human contraband.
Yes, and you look at the across the Mexican border, you're going to find Al Qaeda. You go, and by the way, if you go over to Canada right now, you're going to find some very interesting things. What's going on is we're getting set up, and at the same time, he's saying, "Well, we don't have a problem on the border. You got people killing each other on the border. You got people coming across the border and killing Americans. So something is wrong somewhere, and we don't see it." One of the big problems that I see is the control that the White House has over the press. Obviously, it's coming to the fore now, but it's been going on for the last couple of years. Unless you've got something good to say, you're banned from saying it. And if you do say it, you don't get to come to a White House conference anymore. I mean, that's out in the open now, and this is what they're doing. So there's an underlying something, and Michael, you've known me long enough not to be a conspiracy theorist, but there's an underlying something here that we haven't gotten our hands on.
I tell you, I think the people who constitute the 41-42% of the folks who still are willing to stand up in a poll and say they're siding with the president are those people, the special interest folks, who are getting rewarded by this president for supporting him. I would include among them the public employee unions within my own profession, the trial attorneys, each of those groups who are getting the special favors, who are getting the targeted benefits that the rest of us are not sharing. Those people are bought and paid for, and they are loyal supporters, even if he will occasionally do something they disagree with, such as going ahead with the policy of eliminating bin Laden. Other than that, these folks are getting something from this president that the vast majority of Americans are not sharing in, and those people, their support is bought and paid for, and adding to those the number of folks who will support him blindly because he's a Democrat or support him blindly for whatever other reason, you cobble all those folks together, and it comes up to a substantial amount of the population. But I can remind you, 42-43% is a minority of the total voters.
Oh, Michael, when it comes down to it, the biggest problem that we have, if you say anything against the administration, you're a racist. And that...
Yeah.
And what do you do? You know, what am I going to do? If somebody says you're a racist, am I going to defend myself that I'm not a racist? And the more I say that I'm not, the more it looks like that I am, and quote unquote, I could be anyone. And I think the real problem here is the divide that's gone on in this country. Very subtle. You know, my whole world is in and around communication. And very subtle what I hear is, today was he said something about, you know, we stand up, something about we were in Boston and we wouldn't allow England to tax us anymore. And Rosa Parks sat in the front of the bus. Every time he creates an example, he moves it back to something that had to do with segregation. It is so subtle, but it's that emotional trigger that keeps everything going the way that he wants it to go. There is a divide in this country that was not here 2 years ago.
I think that divide you're speaking about and the emotional buttons that he pushes really work with certain groups of folks in the country who believe themselves still as being victims or being singled out for mistreatment. And certainly while there continues to be mistreatment, there continues to be some racism, there continues to be some things that need correction still going on today, there's been such huge progress that the vast majority of the voting population doesn't buy the charge of racism anymore. They don't buy these claims about we hate all immigrants and we want to construct a moat and put alligators in it. You know, people say, sure, we don't want to hear this anymore. So the charge of racism has lost its bite because it's a card that's been overplayed. And therefore, when he continues to use it, it only works for the smallish percentage of people for whom it works. And then he adds to those groups the people that he provides the special favors for, like the stimulus package. The vast majority of those funds, if indeed not all, went to the public employee unions. They were paid to the states to keep those people working. We've got huge unemployment in the state of California. The national average is about 9%. In California, it's over 12% across the entire state. And when I drive up and down the freeways, or when I creep my way up and down the LA freeways, it may be more accurate, a lot of people are looking for work or having tough times. But you know who's working? All the construction crews working for the Department of Transportation, adding a carpool lane to the 405 freeway. Those public employee unions, they got the stimulus money. They're bought and paid for, and they're part of that 42 and 43% that says we're going to turn out to vote for the president for his reelection. I think that there are probably fewer of them than appear in the polls, and that there's going to be quite a thumping come November of next year.
Now, by the way, public employee, that's it. A couple of things I want to touch on. Before I get to public employees, let's talk about AIG for a moment. There was a stimulus package that went to AIG. If you take a look at the stock market and you take a look at what they're worth today, they have dumped in the last 6 or 8 months. They've gone right down to where they're in trouble again, and we poured a lot of money into them. But public employee, we've talked about this before. Go back to Germany right before the Second World War, when Hitler started to come into power. Nationalization of the schools, nationalized the banks, the lending institutions, and on and on and on. And then pretty soon what you have is exactly what's going on right now. Look at the roadmap. Look at the steps that have been taken. And government, government, government. You've got troops out of the country. If anything happens, if there was ever a coup here, where are our troops? They're thousands of miles away. So I have to sit back and look at this and say, what is really going on here, and what are we going to wake up to? And my biggest concern out of all of this, Michael, is that I haven't seen anybody on the other side, Republican or Tea Party, that I like well enough that will be able to lead the charge to take the country back.
You know, I'm not feeling quite as the same way at all. I think it's so early on in the process that I'm confident that somebody of quality, of whom I think there are a lot on our side of the aisle who are actually running, will rise to the top. And I don't think it's going to be a surprise from like what happened with McCain, because the party rules have been changed to prevent that kind of thing from happening again, and that's probably a good thing, where some really non-conservative candidate is able to take over the party and seize the nomination. I think it's too early to judge that all of our folks who are standing for the nomination are inadequate or lacking. I think what I'd like to do is reserve my judgment to see, as the campaign begins in earnest and the debates really begin, which of these folks, all of whom seem, any one of whom seems more attractive to me than the current occupant of the White House.
Oh, well, yeah, that's about anyone. Absolutely. You know? There's no question about that. And I think that the major concern is not necessarily the who's here now. And you just said it. Someone's going to come up. I would love to see Christie stand up from New Jersey.
Right. I understand. He's appealing for very real reasons. But, you know, were he to join the pack, he may well be labeled by the mainstream media, like all the other current candidates, as, oh, he's really not that interesting. He's really kind of lackadaisical and lackluster. I think that the candidates who aren't flashy and glib are still entirely competent. There are a lot of very qualified people we have who are seeking the Republican nomination. I'm very proud of the pool of people, even if they're not exciting. God knows, I've had enough excitement the last 3 years to last me for a while. You know, somebody taking America from what it's been to a direction that's very dark and depressing and a place I don't want to see it taken. Any of these people will pull it back from that brink and put it back onto the sound track that it needs to move forward on into a bright future. And I'm happy to support almost anyone that is going to become or likely to become the Republican nominee.
Oh, by the way, said that way, Michael, absolutely. There's no question about it. Anything that we can get there is going to be better than what we've seen in the direction that we've seen. But I would love to see a leader in there. You know, Gingrich was looking okay, and then all of a sudden it was the back to everybody should have health care and be forced to buy health care. And I'm thinking, how as smart as you are, could you come up with something like that this early on? And in and of itself dilutes his ability to get where he wants to be. I think that there's a problem in how do I say this? There's a problem in cloaking all of these things. I'm going to give you Pelosi, and you can take her, by the way. And she's from California, so you'll
thanks a lot.
But you know, take a look at the 22 businesses that have been that got the go, and they don't have to have health care. What is it? It's big restaurants. It's places that she's gone, places that she's spent money. We see what's given away, and at the same time, we are not doing anything about it, and we are not standing up. And I'm going to go right back to who cares what's in it? Sign it. You'll know after it's over with. Yeah, you know, sure. Yeah. And she got away with it. That's what the problem was.
You know, on that point, here's kind of a circular way of getting back to it. Using the example of Newt Gingrich, he unleashed a firestorm with his comments the other day about Ryan and the Republican budget plan and the health care. He's now backpedaling, saying he was taken out of context. Maybe he was or he wasn't. In a way, it almost doesn't matter, because what's going to happen between now and the time we move into 2012 is that we're going to get to know each of these candidates who are seeking the Republican nomination. We're going to get to know each one of them. I'm sure each one of them have their weaknesses, but they all of them have a lot of strengths, and their strengths are, you might say, the exact flip side of Obama and where he has been trying to lead this country. And so I think that we will feel better about who would be put up as an opponent or as an alternative to Obama once we get more into the process. I think that that process will clarify a lot of things, including the strengths of all of these candidates, which the mainstream media is not playing up right now. It's playing up their weaknesses and that they're boring and that nothing ever happens when they talk and they put everyone to sleep. You know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. They've all of them have been successful in their lives, doing whatever it is differently that they have been doing. And again, not everything about each one of them is perfect, but they're certainly credible people who I believe to a greater or lesser degree are acceptable to, you know, most conservatives and most Americans who are looking for a return to the America that they knew and that they believe still lurks beneath the surface. I feel much more confident that that will turn out to be true, and we'll all be feeling better, much better about who the ultimate nominee is who stands to oppose Obama than we did in 2008.
And now, by the way, we're running out of time, and the only thing I have to say to finish the segment out is, where is John Wayne when you need him?
I know. I miss him, too.
Hey, Michael Hohmeyer, website we can find you at.
We're at www.hohmeyerlaw.com, HOMEIERLAW.com.
Wonderful. Michael, see you next week. Thanks.
Looking forward to it already, Michael Ray. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there?
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me?
I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
It is time for tips from the publishing guru, Todd Rutherford with us, the founder of the AskThePublishingGuru.com. And as a consultant, he's been involved with the writing, publishing, and marketing of more than 2,500 different books and counting. Todd, welcome back.
Good to be here, Michael.
How are you?
I'm doing good.
Okay. How is the weather in Oklahoma?
It's actually been, it was a little overcast today, but for the last several days, including the weekend, it was just gorgeous here. You know, 70, 80 degrees with a little bit of a breeze and beautiful sunshiny days. So,
man, what happened to, I don't know what happened to summer. It's been, we haven't seen 60 degrees yet here. So something's going on. I think it's a plot from the White House. What can I tell you? Let's get right to the action because, you know, there's so many people. They have blogs, they have websites, but people just pass them by. So you got to captivate that reader to get to that blog and website. The old adage, you know, you can't judge a book by its cover, but the question is that true or not?
Well, you know, you actually can. You know, that statement is so far away from reality that it's important that folks go, you can. And not only can you judge a book by its trouble or by its cover, most people do. Even if you try to say, oh, well, I'm the kind of person that doesn't judge people by, you know, my initial perception of them, or I don't judge books by my initial perception of them, I don't judge websites, stores, whatever the case might be, you may say that with your mouth, but your mind, and you know this more than most because of your expertise, but the average human mind subconsciously immediately forms opinions instantaneously within just the first few seconds. And so whether you want to or not, most people are going to judge things by their first impression. And it's not just books, it's blogs and websites and everything, any way that you plan on presenting yourself or interacting with the public, you know, obviously referring specifically to authors with our segment, you know, it's a matter of your potential readers. Any way that you're going to interact with potential readers in any form, blog, website, book, materials, business card, your even personal appearance, your social media presence, you are going to be instantly judged within a few seconds based on what people see. And so it's extremely important that you begin analyzing and asking yourself, how does my physical or how does my presence and the way I present myself in all the different forms to my potential audience, what type of initial opinion is it going to create in the mind of the viewer?
Now, when it comes down to it, just to take that a little farther, you know, the way to say that is you're a mirror, and that viewer is going to see themselves within you, what they like about themselves, what they dislike about themselves, what they recognize within that what you've put together to see. And it has nothing to do with you. It has to do with what they see. And I think a step up in the game is to know that it's a projection and to realize that you have to step outside of yourself and make sure when they look at it, they're seeing something about themselves that they recognize that's going to cause them some kind of a benefit in their life.
Absolutely.
Now, by the way, first impressions, and you said it, they happen in seconds. I mean, they're just so quick. So a suggestion with a blog, is it the headline? Is it the placement? How do you do that with a blog or with a book cover?
Well, it's a combination of multiple things. But think about this. Imagine the last time that you were standing in line you know, waiting to pay for your groceries and check out. You know, they've got, you know, obviously they're strategically placed. They have all the magazines, especially the ones with all the dirty gossip stories and everything else, right there accessible. But if you think about, why did you pick up that one of those tabloids or one of those magazines? Even perhaps you might not be the person that ever reads those types of things, but you picked one up. Why did you pick it up? Because you liked something about the cover or a headline caught your attention. You know, when you went into the grocery store with the particular intention to only buy milk and bread, and you left out of there with 10 other ideas or products that you had no intention of buying, because when you passed them, something about them caught your attention. And so I know that's the simplest form that you can describe, but that's the key. You've got to catch their attention. And so you start asking yourself about all the different ways that you can catch people's attention. You know, when you visited, you know, the last blog or the last website that you visited, you might ask yourself, what was it about that blog or website that caused you to actually stay there? Because most of the time, they call it a bounce rate in the web and blog site world. You know, you can actually run reports and statistics to see how many people visited your website or your blog and then left instantly and did not click on something else to go deeper into your website or blog to find out more, read more, discover more about you. And most websites that are not properly structured, most blogs that are not properly structured with design and captivation strategies in mind, experience 95% or higher bounce rates. And what you really are shooting for is to improve that number. I mean, obviously, getting it down to where, 90% stay on your website, that's extremely difficult to accomplish, but you can definitely improve it and shoot for getting it to the place where, 50% of the people or better that visit you or some form of interaction with you, blog, website, social media, whatever, are at least going to take a little bit closer look or try to find something of value. And, you know, there are so many different ways that you can take a look at that, different aspects of things that you can start taking a look at about each of the different ways that you interact with people and fine-tuning them to try to captivate folks and take certain steps that will definitely increase that.
You know, it's interesting. I remember this as if it was yesterday. Let's see, Clinton was, it's been what, 10, 12 years since Clinton was in office, something along those lines. And I remember in his last, it was his last term of office. I was in the market, and as I'm walking by the rag magazines, right, it had a headline, and I remember the headline: "Clinton's Adopt Alien Baby." Now, as much garbage as that sounds like, that was the headline, and I'll bet tons of people bought that magazine that weekend.
Absolutely. You know, I remember one of my favorite sort of books out there is a book called Influence, the Psychology of Persuasion by Robert Cialdini. He's a professor of experimental social psychology at the University of Arizona. And his whole field of research continues to be basically trying to find out what causes people to make decisions to do things. And he ended up developing this book that was based on 6 years worth of research that him and his students did with all types of different case studies. And what in a basic nutshell that was really powerful is it determined that as the world has increased and the influx of information and choices has increased, the evolution of the way our minds are hardwired has continued to move towards making more and more quick decisions. Because there's no way that we could process all of the information and all the choices that we have to make what's the best decision. So our brains have created shortcuts. We determine what we should do by what everybody else is doing. We determine whether or not this is a good idea on how close it makes us feel with something we've already done. Commitment and consistency, they call it. You know, these various different features. And so knowing that people are designed and are, you know, continuing to be more and more hardwired to make quick decisions, you have to be mindful about the way you present yourself to be able to make it to where it's not difficult for folks to be able to determine if they should continue to engage further with you as a resource for content, whether it's entertainment, education, inspiration, or, you know, whatever the case might be.
Sure. Todd, it happens in a millisecond, and it's the physiology of the body that causes it. And that decision is made based on emotional satisfaction. What's going to make you feel good about what it is? And you can tell ahead of time the outcome of what's going to happen for you making a decision. It's going to, if you get emotional satisfaction out of it, if you're comfortable with that, that's where the decision's made, and it happens in a millisecond, and it's just like a flood of dopamine comes out of the brain, makes you feel good. That's what you want, and then you move with it. And I think people began to understand, and more today, we're starting to understand how our bodies work and control the outcome of all of our behaviors and what we do. If you get a base knowledge of what it is, man, do you have a handle on it.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, now let me ask you this. When somebody comes in and you look at a headline, what do you do for that headline? What do you do to make that headline stand out?
I think you have to ask yourself, there's a couple of different purposes of headlines that now you have to think more holistically. Every time you do a headline, whether it's a headline on your blog, a headline on an article that you're submitting somewhere else for consideration, and a headline of your website that's going to be one of the first things that people see, there's now two questions you have to ask yourself. Question number one has nothing to do with people. Question number one is, how is this headline going to be interpreted by search engines? Because search engines are looking for specific things. So even in subtitles, this stretches so far, it even stretches to subtitles of your book, how important the subtitle of your book is. You know, not in physical form, but as it's advertised on Amazon.com, Amazon.com is going to return the books for people to consider based on a search, based on how many of the words that that person searched for are present in the title or subtitle of the book first. You know, and whenever someone's searching for something on a search engine, if they're, you know, if I was like, I want the best steak restaurant in Tulsa, and I Googled best restaurant or steak restaurant in Tulsa, then it's going to go out there and search for headlines that have those words in them. So you want to be mindful of how to present a headline in a way that is optimized for search engines, but is also optimized for human beings. And there is a way to cross both of those barriers, but it's definitely different from just, you've got to make sure you're thinking on both sides of the fence. But obviously, you know, it doesn't have to be specifically intelligent for a computer as long as it has those keywords in it. But for a human being, it's got to be catchy, intelligent, fun, exciting, you know. And the key is, which you can speak a lot to this as well with your training and background, you know, but does it actually create a compelling reason for someone to engage, to buy, to do business with you? And I wish I could take credit for that amazing concept, but I learned it from you.
And that's really the key reason. What is the compelling reason? What is it going to cause? What's going to cause you to make that moment? And I really believe, too, it's not the headline in and of itself. It's what the headline means. And I've asked this question 10,000 times, and I really believe this is really the answer to cause people to move. It's like when you ask your wife to marry you, did you marry her or did you marry how she made you feel? And you have to really think about that. There could have been 10 women standing in front of you, but she's going to be the only one that you're going to get that feeling out of. And that's really what the key is. It's not the book. It's how the book's going to make you feel. It's not the headline. It's what you saw in the headline that caused you to realize that it was going to be a great move for you. Does that make sense?
Yes, and I agree completely. I think that it's all the headline has to, whether it's a headline, the title of a book, the name of your website, the name of your blog, all those different things need it the question is, what does it communicate to the potential reader that will cause them to want to move forward? If they're looking, if someone's looking for, you know, a particular for information on a particular subject, you know, how to use Twitter to grow your business, then you, if that's the person that you're trying to find, then obviously the title, the headline of your article, of your blog post, or whatever the case might be, your book, needs to clearly communicate to them in an engaging way that if they read your article, if they visit your website, if they buy your book, they're going to be able to learn how to use Twitter to grow their business. So go ahead.
Okay, I was going to say, and then take it this step farther. What's it going to mean if you got if you've got Twitter to grow your business? It really boils down to how you feel about the you know the decision that you made. And Twitter is the vehicle to get you where you want to go. And I really believe when it comes down to bottom line and the rest of it, the only time we make a decision is whatever that is within us that we're looking for, that we're searching for, that certain something, it's how you're going to feel about it after you get it. And that's really the key to all of it. The only thing that will cause a person to buy anything is the possibility of emotional satisfaction at the end of the rainbow.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, we're starting to run out of time. Now, website we can find you at.
The best way to get in touch with me is askthepublishingguru.com. That is my blog. And all the ways to communicate with me, connect with me regarding social media and everything, telephone, email, you can communicate with me through starting there. Askthepublishingguru.com has got more than 300 different articles on writing, publishing, marketing books. And I always, anyone that's interested in learning more about any one of those areas, I always provide an opportunity for a free 30-minute initial consultation.
Wonderful. Hey, Todd Rutherford, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you real soon.
All right, sir. Next week. Bye-bye.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Dresser After Dark.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold.
What do your numbers say about you, your future, your relationships, your life? We're going to find out. Michael John Fierro with us has been an award-winning numerologist since 1984. His critically acclaimed book, You Know Your Name, Look Up Your Numbers. And Michael, let's say hi, welcome to the show.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we're dealing with this uncertain world out here, as it comes to finances, as it comes to relationship, education, whatever the case may be, there's nothing you can really put your arms around and say, this is how it's going to be. But there is that certain something whereby you can ground yourself, and I've seen it over the years, numerology, the numbers, the power of numbers. Michael, let me ask you this question. Where did it come from, and why is it so critically on target?
Well, numerology dates back at least 2,500 years. The system that I is the Pythagorean system, and Pythagoras is generally considered to be the father of numerology, although there does seem to be evidence that it dates back much further than that, the ancient Chaldeans and maybe beyond. The thing that lends it the accuracy and the credence is this, is that everything in the universe can be reduced to a mathematical equation. Numbers are the singular language of the universe. If you think of the table of elements in science class, they were all numbered. When they put a man on the moon, it's a mathematical equation. When they attempt to contact extraterrestrial life, they send out mathematical equations. They don't send out passages from books. So the numbers are the constant. And
okay,
numerology is based on the numbers 1 through 9 and the alphabet.
All right, so the numbers are the constant, the numbers that will always be there no matter what happens. And if we listen to the numbers as how they symbolize our life and what we do in our life, if we know ahead of time, then obviously we can avoid disasters, i.e. if my numbers come out to be a certain thing, I meet somebody and her numbers say, stay away. If you don't know that, you walk into a disaster. If you do know that and run into somebody and if their numbers run the same thing, it's got to be the same thing in a business or anything else. So how do we create that? What do we do to find out what our numbers are?
Well, again, numerology is based on the numbers 1 through 9 and the alphabet. And when I do a chart on someone, I take their name, the way it is spelled on their birth certificate. And I emphasize that fact, the way it is spelled on the birth certificate. Because even if the name is misspelled, that is what I read. And if you were one of those individuals whom, when you were born, your parents didn't quite know what to name you, and your birth certificate says female or baby boy or baby girl, whatever the case may be, that's what I read. And within the context of your name and your birth date is everything about you. It's your talents, it's your abilities, it's your personalities, it's lessons that you need to learn, it's issues in life. And I can get a very, very complete picture of someone once I know their name and their birth date. And I do use it in dating because I don't want to be dealing with stuff that I have no patience for.
No, I hear you loud and clear. Okay, let's break me down. I think that's and we get an example and we'll use me. My name, my birth name is Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, Ray, R-A-Y, Dresser, D-R-E-S-S-E-R.
Okay. And what's your birth date?
11-14-1942, give or take 10 years.
Well, we need that to be exact.
No, it is exact.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, 11-14-1942.
Okay, what you have is a six-soul urge. That comes out of the vowels in your name. You have a six-personality image number, which comes out of the consonants in your name. And your expression, which is a total of all the letters in your name, is a 3. So both of those sixes make you a very caring person. One of the major things in your life is to be of service to others. Sixes have a tendency to be teachers or healthcare workers or counselors, restaurant workers, whatever. Again, their heart lies, and especially with you with it being in the soul position, your heart lies in of being assistance to others.
Six is the number of home
and family and mother. So one of the things that you need to be careful of in your life is you may have a tendency to attract people with problems. Because six, again, is kind of the mother energy, and people will naturally gravitate towards you when they have issues or problems that they want to discuss.
Okay, now, by the way, go ahead.
Go on.
Oh, no, I was going to say that if we know what this is, and obviously we can head it off at the pass, so to speak, but the key is, or better yet, let me ask you a question. If I would have been born a year earlier or a year later, would that have made a difference in the makeup of the dynamic of what I'm about?
Well, it would have made a difference in your life path. Now, let me give you just a quick rundown on this. The analogy I use is this, that your birth date is the road in life that you are traveling. And your name is the car that you are driving. Now, you can never get off that road because you can't change your birthday. You can change the car because you can change your name. So you have a five life path, which indicates that your life has been one of action and travel and adventure and change. There's an element about you that needs things to be constantly in motion. You might have a tendency to get bored easily. You would love to travel. You would have been very good or very good in sales because five has kind of an innate ability to take abstract concepts and turn them into things that people can understand. So if you had been born a year earlier, you would have had a four life path. A year later, you would have had a six.
Okay, so
we'll look at what it actually is here.
Okay, now, so it would turn out completely different. By the way, you're spot on across the board with everything that you're saying. What I do, in interview after interview after interview, the end result of is what the audience gets, and this has been going on for, almost 28 years now. And everything that you're saying so far caught me right there. I couldn't debate that whether I tried.
Well, thank you. And your three expression, three in numerology is about creative expression. It's about creativity. It's about words, written or spoken. So who you are overall is someone that should be doing something to use words. You can use words to inspire. You can use words to teach. You can use words to create. It also gives you an element of charm and social grace about you. You're kind of the consummate hostess. In fact, I'm sure that if you gave a party at your home, the three would make you the consummate host, and all of that six energy would make sure that your guests' needs were attended to.
You know, it's interesting how people fall into things. You know, my life has been totally eclectic, and my entire world is around everything that you just said. My world is around communication. My world is around broadcasting, and my world is about understanding, allowing people to know what you meant by what you said, being creative enough to allow people to get what it is that you're saying and bring it home in such a way that they're not thinking it's anything else but what you've said and the point that you want to make. So it's all about expression and communication.
Exactly. And, I mean, you've kind of fallen into the perfect line of work for you, because even though you may do a radio show every day, it's always different.
Yeah.
And you're the type of individual that would kind of chafe under routine. You would get bored easily.
No question.
Pardon?
I said no question.
Yeah. So, again, what you do now certainly fits who you are. And the thing with numerology, I have found, if people are really in tune with themselves, they will innately gravitate towards being who they should be. And that's why when I counsel people, and one of the things I always stress very strongly is that I am not a psychic. I am not here to tell people's fortunes. I am not here to do that kind of work. The goal of my work is quite simple. I am looking to empower the individual through understanding who they are, accepting who they are, and then taking responsibility for who they are. And when someone can move into that position, you used the phrase earlier, which I use all the time, about being grounded in yourself. If you are grounded in yourself, then very little will come along that will be able to shake you.
No, absolutely. No question about it. The other thing that I'm hearing also is that if somebody's out in the audience and they're not comfortable in their relationship, they're not comfortable in their occupation, if there's something in their life that doesn't seem right, that's something within that you know is not right, then you've got an answer here. You've got a numerical answer, because if you break it down and you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, and you know that you are, but if you have your way out, you can recreate based on what you know is going to be comfortable for you. We get
exactly.
in trouble. Yeah, Michael,
exactly.
We get in trouble because of what we don't know. But what would happen if everything was now intentional instead of accidental? It takes an entirely different look at it.
Correct.
Okay, correct. So now, but if you're going to meet people, how do you turn around and say to somebody, what's your full name, what's your date of birth, and let me see if I can get along with you? I mean, obviously you can't say that. So somehow,
I do that all the time. I do it especially in dating because, you know, I'm 60 years old. I don't really have a lot of time to waste in going through that whole process.
Yeah.
So I will look at someone's name and at their chart to see what it is I'm dealing with. Because one of the parts of my work that I put a great deal of emphasis on, in numerology there's something called the challenges. And the challenges come out of the birth date. And where the mathematical process in numerology is addition, when it comes to the challenges, it's about you use subtraction as the mathematical process. And the easiest way to define the challenge is that these are the issues or the obstacles to wholeness. These are the things that will send someone into therapy. And I put a great deal of emphasis on it because this is the stuff that's really going to hold an individual back in their life.
Oh, there's
and
no question.
That's the stuff that really needs to be looked at.
There's no question about it. Now there's a life path and there's also a soul urge, right?
Correct. There's four major numbers. The soul urge, which comes out of the vowels in your name, that's your being. That's who you would truly like to be. If I gave someone a magic wand and said that they could be or do anything they wanted, it would very closely resonate to what the soul urge number represents. The consonants create a number that's known as the personality or the image. This is the doing energy. This is the mind energy. This is also the first impression energy. When you meet someone, what you're picking up on is their personality image number. And the personality image number is the way that the soul urge manifests itself into the world. The next number is known as the expression, which is the sum of the parts. This is who you must be in this lifetime. The life path, again, is the field of experience or the environment in which you get to exercise who you are. And the challenges are those roadblocks in life that must be addressed. Now, I put a lot of emphasis on the challenges because in my work I'm able to see addictive behavior. I'm able to see abuse of any sort. I'm able to see control issues or anger or rage, things like that. And obviously those are the things that are really going to create difficulties for someone in life.
Oh, no question about it. Let me ask you this. Are there different forms of numerology? When I say that, let's say I come to you as a client and we break the numbers down and somebody has a little different twist on numerology, but it's numerology, and I go to them and we break the numbers down and it comes out different. Then I go to somebody else and then it may be different. What I'm asking is all numerology constant? You use the words constant. Is it constant? Are you going to get the same thing based on your numbers?
No, because what you have, it's the same thing with astrology. Depending on who the astrologer is and how they do their work and what they focus on, you may get different information. And I personally have some difficulty with some of the numerology books that are out there and some of the numerology forecasting and information that's out there because for no other reason, it conflicts with my belief in what I know. Yes, it's possible for sure that you could go to someone who would give you an entirely different interpretation of what I may say to you. The only thing I can say about my work is I've been doing this for 27 years. My accuracy rate is in the high 90 percentile.
No, I hear you.
And
by the way,
I've been very blessed in my life that I've been able to help people to the point that I will get a phone call or a card or an email thanking me for turning their life around for them.
But how could you not turn their life around? I think that's really the key. If they
because a lot of people don't want to participate in it.
Well, that's a different story. We're talking about somebody who wants to participate, somebody who wants it. If they don't want it, Michael, there's nothing you can do, even waving the magic wand. They're not going to accept it. There are too many people out in life today that feel that failure is their form of success. If I'm failing, you're going to notice me, and that's the only way that they get noticed and they get their identity. So, I mean, that said, absolutely, no question. But those that actually want it, those that have fallen down enough to say, okay, I want to open my eyes, I want to take a look, the key here is if you can see where your weaknesses are, you see where your strengths are, if you put the roadmap in front of me and I can see that map, Now all of a sudden, again, I've got a leg up on it, and I can forecast where I'm going to go. Life now is not accidental. Life, again, is intentional.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And as I said earlier, again, about understanding acceptance and, most importantly, responsibility. Taking responsibility for your life, taking responsibility for who you are. When you take responsibility, you no longer become a victim. And in someone's chart, if I see in someone's chart that perhaps there was a situation of sexual abuse or molestation, now we all know how that can affect someone in life. Now, this is a very bizarre concept, but my belief is if it's in your chart that on some level you asked for it to be there,
sure,
then you need to understand that you're participating in something that you wrote into your life, because I believe that you picked your name and your birth date because on the soul level, your soul knew who it needed to be and what it needed to go through.
By the way, Michael, in my heart of hearts, what I believe very strongly, and I've seen enough of life at this stage of the game, and sometimes it's a game, is that you get exactly what you want. It's not what you need, it's what you want. And deep down, underneath it all, if you need to be molested, if you need to have some kind of a trauma in your life, you're calling it because you believe at that moment you deserve it. And if that's what you think, and it's not a conscious thought, if that's what you think, that's what you're going to get. And most people
right.
who are victims are, if you look in the mirror, you'll find out where the source of the victimology is.
Right. I say that to people all the time. If you want to see the source of your problems or your successes, just go to the nearest mirror, because you cannot externalize all of that. You cannot put it off on someone else.
No question,
you're not going to live a very fulfilling life.
No. And by the way, if I was 20 years old and I would say what I'm saying right now, I don't think I'd give myself much credence. But if you lived enough of life, you begin to see things that a lot of the youngsters don't see, and they're not going to take it in at that moment. I think life, no matter what you look at, is like this. You start your life out, and you're going to have certain challenges in your life. The challenges, let's call them lessons. You're going to have lessons in your life. You're going to get knocked down, and sometimes you get up, sometimes you get knocked down again. If you get what it is that you're supposed to learn out of what happened to you, then all of a sudden you can move on. And you know what the prize for that is? You get another one. And it's bigger.
Right.
And it keeps going on and never stops. Yeah. Okay, we're starting to run out of time. Michael, let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, I do. It is, and now this is a long one, it's numerologyandpersonalempowerment.weebly.com.
One more time slowly.
numerologyandpersonalempowerment.weebly.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Michael, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated the time you spent with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you look for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I'm sure who have told you they would give you the world for a toy.
All I have are these zombies.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. David Goldman with us. He is the author of A Father's Love, One Man's Unrelenting Battle to Bring His Abducted Son Home. He grew up in Ocean Township, New Jersey, son of a charter boat captain, graduated of Virginia Wesleyan College, and he found a career in modeling. He now runs a charter boat business and does advocacy work for international child abduction. And let us say, David, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on this evening.
And thank you so much for being here, David. Your story is probably one of the most heart-touching stories in the country, and the end result is you got your son back. Let's go all the way back to the beginning. How did this begin? What happened when you found him gone? What did you go through, and what was the plan to get him home?
Well, it began by me driving my then-wife, my son, Sean, who was a little over 4 years old, and my in-laws to the airport for what was supposed to be a two-week vacation. And when they arrived, they received a phone call. Everyone was safe, and everything was good. And then I got another call 2 days after that. It happened to be on Father's Day. And it was from my wife at the time telling me that she decided to stay in Brazil with our son, that I'm a great guy, she said, and a wonderful father, the best father she could ever imagine for our son. But she decided to live in Brazil and keep him with her. And if I ever wanted to see him again, I had to sign 10 pages of legal documents that were drawn up by her attorney. And the first one, the first demand on the document was to never, essentially to sign away all my rights to my son, my parental rights, and all his to me, never going to the police to press criminal charges for a kidnapping, because there are laws against doing something like this, of course, and never going to the courts to file for separation or do anything in any way that would interfere with her pursuit of U.S. citizenship. If I do any of these things, then I will spend all my money trying, and I will never see my son again.
David,
let me
hold you up for just a second, because if the situation would have happened from state to state, you know, you're on the East Coast and she goes to California, that's one thing. And there are laws, and state to state, it's a little bit different, but for the most part, the rule of law is there, and we understand it, and we can work, and we can move with it. But now all of a sudden, you're faced with a challenge that most people don't have. Your son is now out of the country. It's a completely different set of laws. And where do you go to start to work with that? Do you get an international attorney? How do you begin that process when you're dealing with someone who, when I say doesn't speak your language, I don't mean English to Brazilian, whatever, but in law, in culture, in society, how do you deal with that?
Well, first thing, there is an international treaty law called the Hague Convention. And then this aspect was on the civil aspects of international child abduction, which Brazil and America and a host of other, 80 or so other countries, are a party to. Because the world is a small place, essentially, with corporations opening up all over and different branches all over and traveling, that there will be relationships. And unfortunately, these relationships don't always work out. And unfortunately, again, oftentimes there is a case where one parent will decide to just take the children, or child in my case, and go back to their native country. And this treaty is designed to return the abducted child within 6 weeks of the abduction, so the child's life will be won't be upset as little as possible. And then you go back to the court of the habitual residence of the child, simply put, where everyone was living, and that court is a competent court of jurisdiction. where all custody matters will be adjudicated. And in my case, Brazil did not uphold their reciprocal obligations of the treaty for 5.5 years, essentially, bringing it to the highest levels of both governments, which is nothing short of a miracle that it got to the level it did, and Sean and I are reunited as we speak. However, while he was held illegally in Brazil, there were some children that had been taken from Brazil to America, and America returned those children. And there's still many children from America and other countries held illegally in Brazil and around the world.
Now, by the way,
so
David, when
there are laws in place.
Let me hold you up. I want to make a point here because I think it's extremely important that there are numbers here. I'm looking at your press release, and there are numbers here that I haven't seen before. I've always felt, or for the most of my life, I've felt that no matter what the challenge is, no matter how horrible the outcome is, there was always something somewhere. There was some growth out of it. And let me read this. According to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children's annual report, 800,000 children are reported missing every year in the U.S., and of that number, an estimated 200,000 are abducted by family members. Now, Bring Sean Home Foundation, which you created, and you created on behalf of other families with similar circumstances, had Sean not gone through that, had you not gone through that, this organization would not have been established, and in essence, it's really a legacy to Sean. And look at the lives that you'll get to touch because of what you went through. And what you went through, I'm sure, was not fun at all. But at the same time, thank goodness that he's back. But the situation in and of itself, it had its good turn.
Well, you're absolutely right. And, you know, Sean and I discussed that. He's been through more pain and suffering than many children. And little, you know, little people shouldn't have such big problems. And we talk about these things, and the overall meaning that, you know, I try to get across to him is our suffering is over, but because of our suffering and the attention that was brought on our struggle, we will help so many other families, and we will reunite more families and bring these abducted children home. We have congressional hearings, in fact, next week, May 24th, on International Child Abduction, to introduce some legislation and to keep the issue shining bright, because there are thousands of American children held illegally. And it's not a top priority because there's 20 in one country, 30 in another, 40 in another. And when an ambassador is appointed, their first order of business is economics, trade, in some, you know, Latin American countries, drugs, gun smuggling, immigration. And our helpless, defenseless children are on the bottom of the list. And yes, as you said, we teach our children about stranger danger, but what do you do when it's a parent or a family member that takes them to across national borders? It opens up a whole other quagmire of a web that it's very hard to navigate through.
Oh, sure. Now, when you're talking about that 800,000 children that are reported, 200,000 are abducted by family members. Now, that leaves another 600,000 children annually, not just over a period of time, annually. You multiply that by 10, and all of a sudden you've got some major numbers there. Shouldn't be one, but you've got some major numbers. Are there any human trafficking involved in this? Are any of these kids sold off as slaves?
Yes, well, absolutely. We're focusing on the parental or, you know, the family member to tackle those. We know most of the time where the children are. We know who's abducted them. But yes, there are the ones who are on the missing list. They go into human trafficking, and there's bills and legislation passed to help these. That's the whole of all the children, and it is an extremely alarming number of our innocent American children being spirited away into forced labor, into sex traffic, it's astounding, and we need to do something. And the State Department should be begging for legislation and begging for help, which we're going to be introducing, as I said, through H.R. 3240, which has almost like a 10-point plan for the children that are kidnapped by under the Hague Convention, or some cases as Japan, who refuses to sign the Hague Treaty. It is to pressure these countries who are supposed to be friends and allies to return our children.
You see, when we come down to it and we look at this, I think one of the major problems, I think one of the biggest challenges you personally face spearheading this is the population, the citizenry. We have no idea that these things are going on. These numbers it was a shock to me when I looked at it, and I pretty well keep my finger on the pulse of what goes on. And the average person will have no idea. If you don't have an idea, then you can't do something to fix it. And I think more and more people to find out, then all of a sudden, I think we're going to get a completely different look at this thing, treat it differently, and maybe do something about it. This has been under the covers, under wraps, for a long time, David.
You're 100% correct. And it's all about awareness. And it is shocking. I'm just I was a regular guy, still am, you know, husband, father, no idea that all these abductions and family abductions and all these things took place. And I had to get schooled on it very quickly. And fortunately, Sean and I are reunited, but we can't accept this gift of being back together as father and son without doing everything we can. And now whatever I can do to be the voice for all these suffering families whose pleas have been falling on deaf ears for many, many years.
That where is the stop at when we talk about deaf ears? Where is it? Are the legislators unaware? Are congressional people unaware? Do they know about this, or do they not know? Do they know and turn their back on it, or do they just not know?
Well, no, I mean, they know that is from their report. So they are 100% aware of it, and we have many good people in the Office of Children's Issues and in our State Department, all with the right and good intentions, but they don't have enough tools in their toolbox to put the pressure on other nations to send us our children. And it's definitely, they're aware of it. The general public isn't aware of it. Could be the reasons. I mean, there's so much bureaucracy that I had to weave my way through in walking the halls of the Senate and Congress over the years, as well as, they want to keep their bilateral relations with these countries as peaceful as can be, and oftentimes it comes at the price of our children.
So what we're saying is the economy, dollars rule which direction that we take. If, you know, the countries want to stay close to each other, that means one country spends and the other one, the other one receives. And I think that's one of the major problems, too. And if we can get over some of that, and we'll never get over all of it, but if we can get over a big part of it, I think we'll do well. I think we've lost focus because the cultures are so different. The societies are so different. We think so differently. And we're not on track. And when I say we've lost focus, what's the most important thing that we have? You know, our humanity, the children that we have, the moms, the dads, the families that we've grown to become aware of. And without that, you have nothing. And I think we've lost it.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, it is. It's the basic level of humanity is having a family. And I understand as well. Economics play a big part, but the give and take, we give a heck of a lot more than we take. We give Brazil nearly $2 billion in trade preferences annually. Jordan has children. We give them $3 billion. Japan, they have nearly 200 American children. Many are missing since the tsunami and the earthquake and the tragedy that country is going through right now. But we rebuilt Japan, again, these countries like to say boo to stir up nationalism. But it goes past all that. To your point, it's about families. Family, all countries know what a family is—the sanctity of a family—and they want their children back. They want our money. Well, send our American children home. simple.
Yeah, no question about it. See, because what they're using is trickle down effect. Trickle down effect means the direction that they take comes from the top, you know, then goes to the bottom. And that's not the way it should be. It's got to be trickle up. It's your family. It's the kids that you raise, the attitudes that you take in life. And our public representatives should be, and I'm going to say should be, a reflection of the public will. The problem is what I'm hearing from you and what I've seen for so long, is they're not a reflection of the public will. They're not a reflection of family, and they're not the reflection of everything that we created as to who we are as a country, as a world, as a sense of humanity. And it's getting lost. And if we're not very careful, you and I are going to be replaced with a BlackBerry.
If we're not on that road already. It's true. Yeah. And, you know, we have this next generation coming up, and it is the age of computers. And, you know, the people, you know, they lock themselves. The kids are on the Internet all day and playing and texting. And, you know, what about just meeting up down the street and having a softball game? You don't see that very often because of all the distractions of the technology age, but also of stranger danger and abductions. It's a different world. It's a scary world, but we do need to go back to the basic of family values. And it's unfortunate that we strayed away.
But David, I totally agree, and I think everybody listening to the show or any of the appearances you make on national TV, etc., after they hear your story, they should go hug their kid.
Oh, yes. And
yes.
Fortunately, prior to my son's abduction, I came from a strong family, a close family. My parents have been married for over 40-some-odd years, and my grandparents were, you know, no one in my family had been divorced. And the bond that I was able to create with my son during his formative years, the beginning of his life, really helped tremendously when we reunited. And you hear experts say that those first 4 years are so important in those formative years, and it really is true. He's home. He's flourishing. He's playing baseball. We're doing homework together. We're riding bikes. It is nothing short of a miracle that brought us back together. It took the death of his abducting mom to really escalate it to the levels and the attention that we had. But nowhere in this treaty and nowhere in the law does it say the child only comes back after the abductor dies. And in fact, it took another year and a half for me to bring him home, because I all of a sudden was entering into a court fight with a man who married her in Brazil while we were still married in America. So it's just incredible that we're back together, and it took so many things to do that. And these other families who are suffering, they need our help. And in the book, we write a whole chapter dedicated to these families, as well as our story, which should open the eyes of a lot of families and hug their children and realize, our children are the most precious and the most vulnerable among us. And as I said before, these little people shouldn't have big problems. Their decision should be if I want chocolate and vanilla, and then arguing when you're telling them it's bedtime. And that's that's what it's all about. That's what, America was all about, family, our roots.
David Goldman, we're just about out of time. And again, the book is A Father's Love, One Man's Unrelenting Battle to Bring His Abducted Son Home. David, website we can find you at?
It's called bringseanhome.org.
Wonderful. Bringseanhome.org. Hey, David, thank you so much. And we're on your side.
Thank you very, very much. I really appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore.
That's all. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Whether it's an earthquake in Japan, tornadoes and flooding in America's heartland, or skyrocketing gas prices, the world seems to be spinning out of control. Our guest, seasoned journalist Thomas Lewis, has been investigating what would happen if a natural or other disaster occurred and left our current technological society without power. The book is Brace for Impact, Surviving the Crash of the Industrial Age by Sustainable Living. Thomas, hey, welcome back.
Thank you. I go by Tom most times.
Oh, Tom works for me.
Okay.
Okay, Tom, by the way, what an interesting thought. We are so technologically oriented today that I don't go out of the house without my cell phone, and I wouldn't know what to do if I couldn't use my toaster or my electric oven.
Yeah, well, that's a problem. And what I focus on is not so much the technology, although that's an outgrowth of it, but the industrialization of our world. Everything is made in huge numbers to get economy of scale, and everything that's done to get that price down, that cash price down, and get the economy of scale increases our risk. And to the point that, and the risk is always deferred. The cash savings are always right now. You can buy this cheap stuff at the store today, and the price of the risk doesn't come way down the road.
No, no question about it. And I really believe, if you would ask most people today, by the way, I knock on wood. I spent 23 years in the interior of Alaska, and if I have to survive, believe me, I know how now. But if you ask most people what they would do without all of these things, without all of the things that make life easy for them today, you get a lot of people that would get very lost and would fall apart and probably not survive it.
Yeah, and that's kind of a shame, because it's not that hard. As you know, if you lived in the interior of Alaska, it's not that difficult. It isn't, as they say, rocket science to learn how to take care of yourself and what food is and where it comes from and what you do to keep yourself warm. Things like that can be mastered. But we have been lulled into a condition where we just don't believe there's going to be any end to this period of unprecedented wealth and greed and selfishness that we've been enjoying for the last 50, 60 years.
You know, by the way, some of the things that we're beginning to see now that we're watching on television, we saw what happened to Japan. Go back a few years, we have Katrina and what's going on right now with the release of water in the South. And those people are going to be in a position whereby if there's too much water, it's going to flood, you're going to be talking 4 or 5 feet over and above the rooftops, et cetera. And they're going to be in a situation that you're talking about right now. So what do we do? What's that basic? What do I do to think ahead? So if something does happen and I don't have that industrial world behind me, how do I survive?
Well, sustainable living is the pursuit. And what I've been focusing on, I'd like to mention my website, which is dailyimpact.net. It's called The Daily Impact, in which I deal with the current events according to the principles of the book. And you mentioned the flood. And for 4 weeks, I have been pointing out on The Daily Impact that when this flood reaches just south of the Louisiana border, it's going to reach a thing called the Old River Control Structure. And that's something the Corps of Engineers has put in place to keep the Mississippi River from doing what it has done since the surface of the earth hardened into rock. Mm. And that is change course every few hundred years. the Mississippi wants to flip over to the Atchafalaya River Basin and abandon New Orleans and the port of New Orleans and the entire stretch of oil refineries and factories and agricultural docks between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And the Army Corps of Engineers has been trying to prevent it since the 50s. And in 73, they almost lost the battle, came within a hair's breadth of losing the battle. And this is a much larger flood. And you will go for days and days and never hear this threat to the economy of the United States even mentioned. I mean, we have to inform ourselves. I'm constantly talking to people about, who think I'm exaggerating the threats to our well-being. It's almost impossible to exaggerate the gathering threats to our food supply, water supply, energy supply that are mounting because of industrialization.
Now, by the way, I want to inject something at this point. I don't think you're exaggerated in any way, shape, or form. If you just listen to what's going on, especially with the potential of what these floods are going to do, even though they did get to circumvent it and move it in a different direction, look at all of the farmland that is being swallowed up right now where these farmers can't produce. What does that mean? That means it's an effect on the economy. It's an effect on jobs. Absolutely right. Everything that goes on with this industrial world that we live in here, everything that happens, good, bad, or indifferent, will affect the economy. It's going to raise it up. It's going to bring it down.
Yeah, by the way, the media is sort of acting like the Mississippi flood is over with now. In fact, USA Today yesterday said, well, this redeems the Army Corps of Engineers. The thing isn't even half over yet.
No.
And some of the gravest threats to levees will come not because of the height to which the river rises, but the length of time that it's going to be in flood stage. I mean, levees can give way long after the flood crest has passed. We're thinking simplistically about that. This disaster has another 10 days to 2 weeks or more to go yet before we know how it comes out.
You see, but it's leveled out. Tom, for all the years that you've been doing what you do, broadcast journalists, etc., that, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. And disasters, death, dying, and destruction is entertainment, quote unquote. Horrible thing I just said, but that's the way it is. If they calm it down now and something happens in 8 to 10 days from now, now they're on it and they've got something to talk about. If we just look at it every day, the average person is going to get bored. They'll shut their TV off, walk by it, and that's the end of it. It has to be exaggerated, and it's too bad that it does have to be exaggerated, because if we wait for these things to happen, it's going to be a disaster. If we prepare and we know ahead of time, then it's not a disaster.
Yeah, it's amazing in this age of the Internet, the age of information, that when a Katrina comes along, you have the leaders of the country saying, well, we couldn't have predicted this. And then eventually they find out that, oh, well, actually FEMA did a complete scenario based on that happening just a few months before it did happen. At Fukushima in Japan, they're saying, well, we never could have expected a tsunami of that size. And it turns out now that they were warned specifically about a tsunami of that size. And all of these disasters and all of these things going wrong are all being predicted by somebody. But they're being these predictions and warnings, the prices that we're going to have to pay for the luxuries that we've been enjoying, are submerged by the tide of industrial whitewash and the lovely Exxon commercials on Sunday TV. Don't worry about a thing. We got 100 years of natural gas under our feet. We're going to find a way to have energy independence. And Archer Daniels Midland is helping to feed a hungry world, and everything's fine. And that's what we get from the major cultural thing that we all share, which is television.
Sure, and there's no threat on the Mexican border. I mean, it's all the same thing,
right? Yeah. The amazing thing about this is with the existential threats to our way of life that are mounting. And in my book, I didn't spend a lot of time on global warming. I regard that as a threat multiplier, and I think there are a lot of things that are going to affect us badly, negatively, before global warming takes full effect. But what we're seeing in the last year or so makes me wonder how it's coming on. It's coming on pretty fast. But what is amazing to me is that there's not a single institution or political leader in this country, not one, that is speaking out clearly about these dangers or calling for the kind of preparation that we would have to do to deal with them. Not one.
Can I give you an answer for that? There's no money in it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. There's no instant 90-day financial statement boosting profit to be made from warning people that their boat's about to sink.
No, and they got it loud and clear. And in and of itself, that's the problem. And we've lost focus. I don't know how many times that I've said these words, and I don't forever and ever, but we've lost focus. If we can stay focused, then we know what we're doing. We can stay focused on life support systems. We can stay focused on survival. But if you ask most people, if you walked out into the street and you got a focus group and you said, you know, what's a life support system? What's survival? And they wouldn't know. Just, you know, have enough in the refrigerator to last you for 3-4 days. We live in this very rapid, microwavable, just do everything right now kind of world. And people aren't geared to think this way. And if something does happen, we all become at the mercy of who's ever in power. And that's the way it works.
Yeah, there was every once in a while the media remember that there's a terrific earthquake coming to California, maybe more than one. And they'll go out and they'll do a piece on preparedness. My favorite answer when they go out and do these man on the street things, and they asked this worthy who was shambling by on the street whether he had an emergency earthquake kit, and he looked vaguely at the interviewer and said, "Why would I do that? There's a 7-Eleven right on the corner."
Yeah. You know, and the sad thing about it, Tom, is it's not funny.
Yeah, and, right. I'm sorry. Was I laughing?
No, hey, by the way, I was laughing when you said it, too. The problem is, yeah, is it's not funny.
It truly is not. And it's reached the point now where, you know, we're on the Titanic, the bow is down, and everybody wants to stay at the all-night buffet, all you can eat, and have another drink and listen to the band. But reality is that the floor is tilting, and there's the sound of inrushing water, and those who can do something had better do it. And the irony is that it's not hard to do. I mean, to find a place, you can't do it in your 50th floor condo in New York. You simply can't. People constantly want to know the answer to the question, how do we save everybody? And the answer to that question is, we can't. But anybody who wants to look into the requirements of producing their own food, their own energy, and living in a safe place can do so. We know how to do it. We have, as they say, the technology. It's not easy. It's relatively simple. Involves some very, very hard choices. You're going to have to choose, for example, between money and security. And that's not a choice anybody's going to make until they're convinced that their security is at issue. And what the Daily Impact website does is bring you the information you need to understand that your security is at issue.
Yeah, and by the way, when we deal with that, I remember living in Fairbanks. You know, it would get to be 40, 50 below out there, and cold enough that if you got out there and you weren't prepared, it could kill you. I mean, there's no question about that. So we were ready for survival. There were times electricity would go out, and I had alternate sources where I could get the electricity from a generator that ran right outside, and it would fire the house up, and it wouldn't go up the pole and so on and so forth. And just when I got to the Milwaukee area, I was living in a place where it was a nice house, and the electricity went, and it was in the middle of wintertime. And where was the thought? The thought was, okay, I happen to have I've got portable heaters, non-electric portable heaters, gas, whatever it was operated, and I covered some of the rooms. I took blankets and put them up all around the living room, got the heater in there, and we were fine until such time as the electricity went back on and so on and so forth. If you've been someplace and you know that something can happen, you prepare for it. But if you don't know what could happen, and by the way, what I just said was very minor compared to what you're saying. But at the same time, if you know, okay, do something. If you don't know, you're going to be in major trouble.
Yeah, yeah. It and people talk about this as though I were discussing the end of the world, and I really want to make the point. This is we're not talking about the end of the world. We're talking about the end of one kind of world, and it's called evolution. Those who are not adapted to the new world are going to have a very tough time staying in it. But those who do adapt will find that there's a pretty decent life on the other side. It's going to be very different than what we know. But what we know is based, for example, on the consumption of a finite amount of oil. I mean, cheap oil has been the basis of our life in the civilized world for nearly 100 years now. And it's running out. And one day, logic requires us to recognize, and arithmetic, that one day it will be gone. And again,
it's not renewable,
Again, I say that not one institution or political leader in our country will even discuss it, let alone talk about what we should have been doing 20 years ago to get ready for that moment.
See, I look at what you're saying in a completely different way. It's not doomsday, the end of the world. What you're saying is here is a bridge to survival. If you take a look at it, if you follow the steps, you and your family will live through it. If you don't, there's the potential of you're not going to make it.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And it's very difficult to get through the paid-for commercial announcements and the spin that's being put on. I mean, we have the spectacle of the most backward legislative body in the world at the moment, the Congress of the United States, denying climate change, denying evolution, denying taxation, and denying a lot of other realities so they can keep their jobs. But, I mean, the IQ of our country has been driven down to a shoe size area by people who do not want to discuss the real problematic things that we face.
I could talk to you all night about this, but we're starting to run out of time. Thomas, the website again, please, where we can find you and get the book.
It's called The Daily Impact, and you can Google that, or the technical address is dailyimpact.net.
Wonderful. Hey, Thomas Lewis, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time that you've spent and all the work you've done with the book.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate your time as well.
Okay, take care. Good night.
Good night.
And the only heart I own for you and you alone, that's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night, that's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Andy is with us. She's the author of The Best Pharmacist. Now, for 20 years, she was a registered pharmacist by day and a full-blown drug addict by night. She'd even sneak out of her home at 2 a.m. traveling to the most dangerous parts of town, wearing nothing but a nightshirt and a lady Smith & Wesson that's a gun tucked between her legs in search for drugs. Not even kidney failure or waking up on a flatbed truck heading down I-95 to Florida with no idea how she got there could deter her from drug abuse. And let us say, Anne, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, friend. I'm so glad to be back with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. What starts it? What causes a person to move down that road for addiction?
Okay, addiction is a mental disease that we are born with. It's something we innately have when we're born. And you know from the age of 2 or 3 that you are different from other people. But it is a mental disease that it has been proven that it is. And so it just takes root and grows from there.
Now, Anne, as a registered pharmacist, is it a chemical imbalance? Is it something genetic? What is it that stimulates this? What's that base that will cause you to be like this?
It's genetic. The scientists call it the X factor. For instance, Michael, if you, a non-drug addict or a normal person, and I were subjected to a brain scan, and they passed a drug, say cocaine or heroin or any drug past us, the receptors in your brain would stay normal. But in my brain, the dopamine receptors would light up like a Christmas tree. So that proves that it is something, you know, genetic in us,
sure.
And it is called the X factor.
Yeah, but the trigger for the dopamine, that's the feel good. That comes from the pleasure and pain center of your emotions in your mind or your brain. What causes that to do it? It's like if you make a decision about something and you really know in that millisecond that's for you, it's also a dopamine rush. So we're saying is that this rush can be either good or bad.
Yes, but that is part of the disease. We have a mental obsession. It's an urge that we cannot control. It's a mental obsession and a physical craving. But the mental obsession has to be reined in, and you have to replace that obsession with something else. Anytime you take away something, you have to put it back with something else,
now,
and that something else is the 12 steps.
Now, when we talk about this, is there anything that can affect the dopamine? Is there anything that can affect that part of the brain that will cause it to short circuit and not go when, quote unquote, the cocaine or the whatever it is passed by you?
Sure, and they have a drug available now in Europe, and they have a drug available here that does that. But in my opinion, as a recovering drug addict, you're just replacing one drug with another.
Okay. And by the way, coming from your perspective, being a drug addict at one time and also being a pharmacist, my goodness, you couldn't ask for more than that as far as the legitimacy of what you're saying. You're looking at it from both ends, yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
No, it's very true. Now, what was it that got you back on the path? What was it that allowed you to manage, and I'm going to say manage the addiction?
Right. Well, I'm glad you said that, because addiction is something that can't be cured, but it can go into remission, just like my cancer is in remission. But what got me on a sober path is when I was arrested and taken to jail. And in that jail cell, in that moment, that was a defining moment of my life. And I knew it was either get well or die. Because when I was arrested at that time, I was doing like 20 Ambien within a 24-hour period. I was doing heroin whenever I could get it. And that was injecting it. So
yeah.
I would have probably been dead at the end of that week if I had not been arrested. So that was divine intervention.
So thank goodness. Okay, now Charlie Sheen, let's talk about him for a minute. We see him sober. We see him off again and back and forth and back and forth. And like a lot of other people, even the younger ones than him, some of those these great-looking young actresses that have the world going for them, Lindsay Lohan and the rest of them, every time you turn around, they're back in rehab, in and out and in and out and in and out. Now, from what you talk about, and I think it's very important, there's a spiritual component that has to be incorporated here to get things to get back into balance.
Oh, definitely. And going back to Charlie Sheen a moment, there is a difference between being sober and sober-minded. When you're sober, that means you just quit doing a drug or a drink for a while. Sober-minded is when you actually work the 12 steps and you develop humility, which then and only then can you get sober, because you learn to kill your ego and your children of ego.
Okay, so really it's getting beyond yourself.
Definitely. You have to get rid of yourself, because addiction is such a selfish disease, and you have to kill that ego, which is self, and self-will, and you have to replace it with something, which is humility.
Now, Anne, we've heard time and time again about the 12-step program, and for so many people that it has worked wonderfully for, you know, there will always be an addict, but what they do is they take that that compulsion, that whatever it is going on with them, and they turn it to something else. It's always there. They just turn it. Now, you talk about something called a 13th step that most organizations don't have. What are we dealing with?
Yeah. Over the past 10 years, when I was helping other addicts get sober, many of them relapsed, and I wondered why. Why can't these people get sober and stay sober? And in my research, I realized that it was because of really two main factors that I work with, and I call the 13th step. You know, Dr. Bob and Bill co-founded AA in 1935, and since then, we have learned a lot about brain chemistry. So the first thing that I incorporate into my program and is the admission that you have a mental disease. No one wants to be told they're crazy. I didn't, but we are. We have a mental disease, and you have to accept that. And if you don't, you will die. This is a matter of life and death. And so I have exercises that deal with that. And the other, I've already mentioned, the other component of my 13th step is learning to kill your ego and children of ego. And a lot of people relapse because they don't do this, which is part of the 5th step. But if you don't work these steps honestly and thoroughly, you will relapse.
Now, by the way, let me hold you up for a minute, because I don't want to go too fast and somebody misses something up. When you talk about exercises, what kind of exercises are we talking about?
Well, first of all, just like these mental exercises I do with games like memory or concentration, I start them off at a point where they are at point X. And in 30 days from now, they have learned so much more. They have been able to concentrate so much more. And I also show them figures and studies like the one I just mentioned about the brain scan. So I try to show them that, you know, you might not think you have a mental disease, but you do. And then the other part of that, the humility part, I actually make them do things that are pretty humbling. For instance, at AA, at the AA meetings, yes, I make them scrub toilets. I make them scrub floors. I make them clean. But the most important thing I make them do is give speeches, because the more you get up and talk about yourself, the more you get honest, and the more you're going to get sober and remain that way.
Oh, no question about it. And I really believe one of the things that occurs when somebody has an obsession, when they have a mental illness, is all of those things that they can't get out of themselves gets locked inside. And you can do it, quote unquote, through mental exercises, through physical exercises, and being able to talk in a place whereby you know that it's safe not to be judged. And I think that's critically important. But when these things start to come up, they become externalized, and if they're externalized, they begin to dilute what runs you inside.
Yes, and I think, you know, talking about Charlie Sheen, I don't think Charlie Sheen knows that he can get sober and live a day of sobriety without a drug. I did not know there was a way to do that. I did not know there was a way to live a day of my life without a drink or drug. And I see it in Charlie. He does not have the spiritual tools to get sober. He does not know there's a way to get there. I think he wants to get sober because I don't think anyone wants to live that life. It really is a dirty, filthy life. And, you know, of course, hygiene and everything else goes, and you can see that with Charlie Sheen now with his teeth coming out and things like that.
And some of his personal appearances, you could see it.
You could see it.
Yeah, absolutely you could. And I really believe that there are a tremendous amount of people out there that want help. They just don't know what steps to take to get it. And they can go to different therapy groups, et cetera, and it doesn't work. Because a lot of these groups are just missing what that essence is. And I think the essence is the value for being sober is senior to the value for not being sober. You've got to have something to make it worthwhile to take that step and to do it. When you were an addict, there was nothing that was more valuable to you than the addiction. And when you found something that was more valuable to you, the addiction started to neutralize, and then you did what you did to make it go away.
You're right. I mean, you have to find that place. And I know I'm going to step on a lot of toes, but I am a firm believer that only an addict can get an addict sober. That's why I really have a lot of questions about Dr. Drew. The Jeff Conaway guy, you heard about him today.
Yeah. Now, by the way, very quickly, I want to make a point that when you said it takes an addict to be able to work with an addict, absolutely. How are you going to sit down with all of the problems that you have and have somebody academically tell you how to clean up when you're looking at them saying, you're not going through the pain, you're not going through the challenges, you have no idea what's going on inside of me. But if you get somebody who's been there, done that, then all of a sudden that bond is there because they know that you know.
Yeah. And I don't know if you saw Jeff Conaway on the Dr. Drew Celebrity Rehab a few years ago, but it was obvious that they were coddling him, and it was obvious they were doing more harm than good. And I don't know if you ever saw the first season of Celebrity Rehab. But
I don't want
the
to.
Graduates,
I just couldn't do that.
I have, you know, I quit watching it too because it infuriated me so. But Dr. Drew made his graduates serve alcohol to their guest. Now, can you please tell me what kind of sense that makes?
By the way, I think it makes no sense, but listening to you tells me what he was trying to prove, that you had enough self-control that you didn't have to drink and everybody else is doing it, which I think is total garbage. Proving that when you're in front of people is one thing. Go do that when you're alone. It's a whole different story.
Yeah, and like I said, we have no control because that urge is so great. And, you know, when you get sober, you learn that urge lasts anywhere from 45 seconds to 3 minutes. So if you can just put the 12-step program between you and that drug, which, of course, I have to do a lot every night that I work as a pharmacist, then you can overcome that urge. But in a newly sober person or a non-sober person, that urge is so great. It's just an obsession. And that is, if you look the word up, it's mental. It's, you know, it's a mental disease if you're obsessed with something.
You know, to take it a step farther also, Ann, I grew up in a world where when I went to junior high school, nobody knew anything about drugs. And in high school, about the 11th grade, we started to become aware of it. It wasn't like the world is today. These kids can get anything they want, anytime they want it, yada, yada. It was not an issue in those days. And even if somebody had the propensity to become an addict, it wasn't in front of you to take that step. So I would venture to guess that there have been a lot of kids when I went to school would have become addicts if they would have had presented to them then what the kids are presented with today. Did I lose you?
Yeah, you did.
Oh, okay. Oh, no. Oh, okay. Let me repeat it. That the kids, when I was going to school, didn't have the ability to get all the drugs that the kids have today. And I would venture to guess that a lot of the kids that I went to school with that had the propensity to become an addict would have. The only thing that saved them, there was nothing there to tempt them with. And today, there's way too much out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know about that, because I think that if you're an addict, you're going to find the drugs or alcohol. But today, it's so glamorized. It's so celebrated. You know, these young stars in Hollywood, what happens to them? Look at Lindsay Lohan.
Oh, sure.
It's just so celebrated, and it's not glamorous.
No. And we're starting to run out of time. Website we can find you at.
My website is under construction, but you can certainly email me at thebestpharmacist@gmail.com.
Wonderful. And that'll be our website in case somebody missed
it.
Go ahead.
Thank you. And on Facebook, it's The Best Pharmacist.
Wonderful. Hey, Andy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michael. Thank you so much for spreading the word. Take care.
Good night.
Good night.
But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't anymore. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I ended with you again.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends,
but
is a wrap.
The curtain falls.